I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gale Rosen. This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. On election night, Republican Governor Phil Scott easily won re-election to a second term in office. He told his supporters that he'll continue to pursue an agenda of affordability in the next 2 years.
We want the kids in every community to get a great education, learn a trade, pursue the career of their dreams, buy a home, start a family, and retire right here in this state. This is the challenge we face together. And tonight, I humbly accept that challenge once again.
Many Vermonters did some active ticket splitting on Tuesday night. They voted for Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, Democratic Congressman Peter Welch, Republican Phil Scott, and then Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman, who ran as a progressive and a Democrat. What is the message of this election, and how will the election results affect Vermont politics in the years to come? These are a few of the questions we have for our panel today. With us, Ellen Anderson, a professor of political science at UVM, Matt Dickinson, a political science professor at Middlebury College, and Paul Heintz, a senior political reporter for 7 Days. Welcome to the program. It's great to have you.
Hey, Bob.
Hey there.
Great to be with you.
Well, I'd like to start with our panel and ask you all the same question, and that is, what is your biggest takeaway from the results on election night? What stands out for you as some of the more significant developments? Ellen Anderson?
I think when you look at Vermont in the context of the nation and Vermont in the context of the Northeast, one of the most fascinating aspects of Tuesday night's election is that you can really see that the Republican Party as a whole has all but collapsed in the Northeast, if we take a look at particularly the very Northeast states. And yet, while that's true when we think about national office, at the state level, right, voters returned Phil Scott to the governorship. New Hampshire voters put a Republican in the governorship. Right. So we have this difference between how we think of Republicans within our state and how we think of Republicans nationwide.
And do you think folks look at the statewide offices and make a determination that this is a person who's setting the state budget, who has a much more hands-on experience with state government? Is that a factor?
I think that you can only understand how Vermonters vote when you realize that while we have as strong opinions as any other people about parties as a whole, when we think about what's going on within our state, party becomes less of a defining feature.
Matt Dickinson, what's your takeaway from Tuesday night?
Well, I'm going to echo the same point. And again, I think one of the questions the Republican Party has to ask themselves in Vermont is, which direction do we want to go? We can follow the lead of Phil Scott, be somewhat socially moderate, but a fiscal conservative, or we can follow the lead of the National Party, which is hitched their wagon to Donald Trump. And we've seen many New England states follow the same model we saw here, choose a Republican governor and a democratically controlled legislature. And there's a lot of political science literature that suggests that makes a lot of sense if you think you're looking for the governor to sort of hold the line on spending, but you want a legislature to protect the least vulnerable in society. And we'll leave it up to our elected officials to sort of work out how you do that. I think the message from Vermont voters was, let's see you compromise. Let's see you bridge those differences and exercise leadership.
And so, Matt, you think that the idea of divided government was a very conscious decision made by our voters?
At least enough of them. Again, you know, when you're voting for your local assembly, your representative, you often think of, well, constituent service. What can they do for me? What kind of programs will they support? Are they in favor of higher minimum wage, family leave? But when you think about the statewide role of the governor, then you're thinking, well, who's protecting us as taxpayers? Who's protecting the state treasury? So whether it's ideology or a different view of the functions of the governor versus the legislative assembly, or just the desire to balance off two opposing philosophies, it only takes a few people to think that way to end up with divided government. And yeah, I think it's a clear message. They want these elected representatives to work together, not in opposition.
Paul Heinz, what's your takeaway?
I thought the most interesting result in Vermont, at least, was the change in the composition of the Vermont House. And so, last session, the session that's ending, that is, Democrats held 95 seats in a body of 150. They held 83 seats in a body of 150. They picked up 12 seats in this election. When you combine their numbers with the Progressive Party numbers, they held steady at 7 seats both this year and next year. You get a combined 102 seats, and that is more than two-thirds. So that means that Democrats and progressives can now override vetoes from the Republican governor. That was already the case in the Senate, but during this past biennium, there were 14 vetoes that Governor Scott issued. 14 vetoes, and the legislature was not able to override those vetoes because Republicans in the House held just enough votes. They no longer do. So that's really going to change the way things work in the state house next session.
And Paul, when you look at those 95 Democrats, it's unusual to have them all vote the same way on any kind of roll call vote. So do they really hang together on a veto override?
Well, I think that is the question to ask. So it is definitely possible to oversimplify what happened here and say, oh, all of a sudden, Democrats and progressives are going to get everything they want. Anyone who follows the Vermont legislature knows that legislators really don't vote in lockstep. That's especially true in the Senate, where party affiliation really doesn't matter all that much. The majority and minority leaders in the Senate have never really had a ton of power because you've got a bunch of very individualistic state senators. In the House, that's also true. It's very difficult to corral, a large number of Democrats in the Vermont state, in the Vermont House. You can ask any speaker and they'll tell you the same thing. So on the issues that I'm going to be looking at closely next session, things like increasing the minimum wage or enacting a paid family leave bill or perhaps establishing a tax and regulate marijuana system, all of those are potentially achievable, but none of them are locks because there are a lot of Democratic House members who aren't going to support them. And of course, I should mention, especially with pot, there are some Republican House members who will. So we shouldn't – it's a very significant change, but we shouldn't oversimplify it and assume that every single liberal priority is now going to go through against the wishes of the governor.
Well, as we mentioned, voters did decide on Tuesday night they wanted divided government in Vermont by reelecting Republican Governor Phil Scott. And as Paul just mentioned, in the Vermont House, the Democrats picked up 10 seats to have 95 members compared to 43 Republicans. And the Democrats gained one more seat in the Senate. They now hold a 24-6 majority there. Here's Governor Phil Scott on this development.
In electing a governor of one party and a legislature by another, the message Vermonters have sent to us tonight is clear. Work together.
Matt Dickinson, in the 2018 session, as Paul mentioned, Governor Scott vetoed 14 bills. So do you think he's going to have a new approach, a new strategy with the new session?
He's going to realize tactically that sort of wielding that veto threat is going to be much less potent. Now, he has some tools to bring to the table here. He can point to an overwhelming reelection in a predominantly blue state. So he won 13 of 14 counties. So this was pretty widespread support. So he's got a seat at the table, and he can claim that by virtue of the voters' support. The difficulty becomes, and I think Paul is exactly right here, we can't assume the Democrats are going to hold together on something like minimum wage. You might see Democrats on the border with New Hampshire being kind of reluctant to embrace a higher minimum wage. So there's still room for compromise. I don't think Scott is going to abandon his principles, but he's going to have to tone down the rhetoric and probably be a little more conciliatory and decide on which issues he wants to stake a claim on principle and which he's going to concede a little more ground. The other thing to think about is we do this all again in 2 years. And so in part, Phil Scott has an opportunity to sort of stake out ground here and looking ahead and saying, here's my record. I tried to stop this raiding of the Treasury. The Democrats overruled me. Let's make this a campaign issue.
And House Speaker Mitzi Johnson spoke about this divided government this week. She said she hopes the governor will be more willing to work with the Democrats in 2019 than he was in 2018.
I think growing the majority to balance the power between the legislative and executive branches will hopefully help to bring him to the table in a much more productive way than we've seen in the last 2 years.
So, Paul, it's sort of on both sides. How will the Democrats react to having these new larger majorities in the House and the Senate? And how will the governor deal with it as well?
Well, it's a very good question. I think, I agree with the point that Matt was making, and that the governor is going to really have to make some choices, and they might be issue-by-issue choices. I think in some cases, he may see the writing on the wall and choose to moderate this legislation, basically say, hey, I'll consider signing this if you scale it back a little bit. In other cases, he may say, forget it. They're going to override me anyway. I'm just going to let them own this. We saw this, I think, last in 2009 when Governor Douglas, a Republican, was in power and there was a Democratic legislature. The governor ended up allowing didn't allow it, but his veto of the budget was overridden and the Democrats owned that budget. So, in some cases, I think you may see him coming to the table. In other cases, you may not. The Democrats also have to make some choices, right? You can twist arms only so many times in a legislature. So this is especially going to be the case for Speaker Johnson. She's going to have to decide what are my priorities here? What are the votes I'm going to ask my more moderate, my more vulnerable members to take that might be tougher votes back at home? So, I think a lot of people are going to be having to make a lot of tough decisions.
Now, Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman also won a big victory on Tuesday night with a larger margin, I think, than many people expected. He thinks raising the minimum wage and providing paid family leave will help draw more young families to Vermont.
Folks want to work where they know if they have an issue with their child or their parent, they can have a few days of paid insurance to take care of their family and be with their family. These are the kinds of policies that will actually draw people to Vermont, not rhetoric about how hard it is to be here.
So, Ellen Anderson, the Republicans, the Democrats, and the progressives, I think, largely agree on the major problem facing the state. It's that huge demographic challenge. While the overall population of Vermont will grow about 1% in the next 12 years, the number of Vermonters over 65 will increase by 50%, but where we see the parties differ is how to specifically address this challenge?
I think that's exactly right. Look, in some ways, everybody wants the same thing, right? We all want to live in communities with low crime, with good education, where we can afford to live, where we know that our families will be happy. And every member of every party wants those things. The tensions are sort of how you go about trying to achieve those sort of objects that we all want. In political science and economics terms, we would call them goods, even if they're not actually tangible things. All right. So Democrats have these sets of ideas, right, that include things like raising the minimum wage to make it easier for folks to live here, whereas Republicans tend toward making arguments about doing everything they can to keep taxes lower and cutting taxes even more. In either case, it's both about putting more money in people's pockets, right? The question is, which is the approach that's more likely to actually generate economic growth and to bring young families back into Vermont or to keep them here instead of them leaving in the first place?
Today in the program, we're taking a look at some of the messages of the 2018 election from Tuesday night. Our panel consists of Matt Dickinson, a political science professor at Middlebury College, Paul Heintz, a senior political reporter for 7 Days, and Ellen Anderson, a professor of political science at UVM. Let's talk to Mike in Essex Junction. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for taking my call, and thank you in advance to the panel. I have a quick comment and then a question. I disagree respectfully with the first speaker that you had right out of the gate. I don't think the Republican Party I think they took a huge blow in this election. I think there were four that I can think of right out of the gate where there was a great loss of institutional knowledge with the legislature that you've lost. I don't think Ms. Johnson, with all due respect to her, I don't think she's going to be in all that much of a compromising mood, to be honest with you. And I think the Democrats and the progressives voted in a way to cut off their nose to spite their face.
And do you have a question there, Mike?
I do have a question. I'd like to know a little bit more detail from the panel about how they think that anything is going to get done down there. I don't quite share the optimism of the panel.
Okay, Mike, thanks very much for your phone call. Paul Heintz, you follow things at the State House very closely every day of the session. What about Mike's question? How does anything get done? Does it get done?
Things do get done in the Vermont legislature. You know, no matter whether Republicans or Democrats are in charge of the governor's office or the legislature, you know, I think unlike in Congress, people still talk to one another. People still compromise. I would say that in this last session, we saw less of that than usual, hence the special session that was called to address some vetoes. But still, when you compare the Vermont government to probably, you know, just about any other governmental system in this country, I think people do find a way eventually to address issues and to address problems. I also just want to mention or respond to a point that the caller made about loss of institutional memory on the Republican side. I think that is true. There were a couple of, I thought, very interesting losses on that side. Kurt Wright being one of them. He's a longtime moderate Republican from Burlington. He was the last Republican from Burlington serving the legislature, and he lost his reelection race. There were a couple other moderates who lost, who haven't served quite as long, Brian Keefe, Fred Baeser, both Republicans, and they were both defeated by Democrats. You know, so we've seen kind of a loss of this more moderate Republican sub-caucus in the legislature. At the same time, we have also seen in recent years fewer blue dog Democrats in the House. So that, you know, things could be a little bit more polarized. I don't want to overstate that point, but I think it's a dynamic to look at. There are also fewer independents in the House this time around. I believe it went from 7 down to 5. So, you know, parties may play a slightly greater role in the House, at least.
Let's talk to Julie Lynn, who is calling from Mallets Bay. Hi, Julie Lynn. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. So my comment and question, and your last speaker touched on this briefly, I wonder how much of Phil Scott's victory was not people who actually wanted him back, but more that he got lucky in beating the so-called blue wave, as we saw with Kurt Wright and in the legislature, because outside groups didn't spend nearly as much money on Christine Hallquist as they did on Sue Minter in 2016. So I'd just be curious as to your panel's thoughts.
That's a great question, Julie Lynn. Matt Dickinson, we saw a lot of money spent 2 years ago by both the Republican Governors Association and the Democratic Governors Association. We didn't see that money from the DGA this year, did we?
Not nearly as much. The money and support of Hallquist came in kind of late in the race, probably not enough to make a difference. The caller's absolutely right. The question is, why didn't it come in? And one explanation is These outside groups are very careful about where they're spending their money. They want to make the biggest impact potentially on a race. And they made an estimation, I think, very early that Phil Scott was a strong incumbent. It's really difficult to defeat an incumbent, even in a state that's trending blue. And for a lot of reasons, you could explain Phil Scott's victory as more than just luck, but a conscious decision by voters to have somebody in there as a check on the legislature. And as I think Ellen and I both said early, this isn't the only state to do that. We see this happening in a lot of New England states where they retain a Republican governor but switch over to a strongly Democratic legislative assembly. So I would attribute his reelection to more than just luck.
Let's talk to Roger, who is calling from Lincoln. Hey, Roger, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity to share my thoughts. I was calling just to say that, in my opinion, in the discussion about the governor's race, there's an elephant in the room, and that's the transgender issue. Although it is mentioned often, I don't hear a lot of discussion about it. I personally am a left-leaning independent. I tend to be progressive, but I don't fit into the political boxes that we hear talked about. I voted for Phil Scott in the previous election, and to tell you the truth, was quite disappointed in his unwillingness to collaborate. But I did vote for Phil Scott this time around more as a vote against Christine Hultquist. Because I don't feel that she represents me in the fact that she is a role model for our young people. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Okay, Roger. Ellen Anderson, how much of this was an issue in this campaign, do you think?
That is an excellent question, and it's one I wish I had a better answer to. We don't really have any data about how voters were thinking about Hultquist in terms of her gender identity. I mean, we can make some assumptions that in super liberal Chittenden County, the fact that Hultquist is transgender was probably not anything that held her back, might have in some cases even given her a little bit of a lift. But that in other parts of the state, it's certainly possible that folks were uncomfortable with sort of not just her gender identity, but the fact that she's sort of relatively recently transitioned, so that sort of issues about this sort of change in public persona, not that Christine Hultquist changed, but that folks who were aware of Christine Hultquist when she was running the electric co-op, but sort of knew her differently, might be somewhat uncomfortable. It's not become sort of, I'm going to say the word normalized, but I want to be careful here. I just simply mean it's not something that has just become the regular same old, oh, that's just Christine, we've known her for 20 years. I think the best thing we can do, though, is we can look at a sister state. We can look at Massachusetts. All right. So Massachusetts had a ballot question this year on whether or not the state should keep its recently enacted civil rights legislation. And this rights legislation specifically barred discrimination on the basis of gender identity. Right. So there was enough opposition to this among the general populace that they were able to bring this to a vote in Massachusetts. And I think the important thing here is Massachusetts voters voted overwhelmingly to keep this law in place. And by overwhelmingly, I mean by more than 2-1. And even more importantly, even though the relatively conservative areas of the state voted to keep this law in place. I was looking at that as the closest as I could get to a proxy for how we might be thinking about Hultquist, how sort of regular voters might be thinking about her. And what I get is that if even pretty darn conservative areas of Massachusetts are voting overwhelmingly to keep this kind of law in place, I think that most of us are getting comfortable enough with issues of gender identity that it probably didn't actually push that much of our voting behavior.
Paul, what do you think?
Well, it's so hard to say because, you know, as Ellen said, we don't really have that much data here. You know, just to push back a tiny bit on Ellen's point, you know, I think that it can be a different thing to vote on the question of whether a group should be afforded certain civil rights. That can be different than actually pulling the lever for a person who is from that group. You know,
oh,
I think,
agreed.
And I think, you know, there are a lot of people who I think who and you see this in races throughout the country, where if you ask them, you know, do you believe in civil rights for this group or that group, you know, that might be different from how they actually internally make a decision about a candidate. So anyway, it's very difficult to measure. You know, one thing I would just note here is, you know, Ellen mentioned the Chittenden County suburbs, or the Chittenden County areas perhaps being, you know, a more liberal place where it might be more welcoming. One of the more surprising results I thought was just how well Governor Scott did in that area. I mean, he won Shelburne, Charlotte, Hinesburg, Richmond. You know, he really cleaned up in Chittenden County, and you just can't win an election in Vermont as a Democrat without doing very well there. You know, if you look at the town by town results, Scott won 230 towns, or I should say 230 precincts, and Hallquist won only 44 of those. Some of those were clustered in down in Windham County and a few in the Upper Valley. I should note that there was one town that was evenly split, and that was Whitingham. You know, Scott did very well across the board. And in fact, he increased his margin of victory over 2 years ago when he was running against Sue Minter. He defeated her by 8.8 points. And this time around, he defeated Hallquist by about 14.7 points. You know, we don't know exactly why, of course. One big factor, no doubt, is incumbency. You know, as you can tell from all of the results around the state this year, incumbents do very well here. They always have. So that could be part of the reason.
Ellen.
Yeah, I want to sort of jump back in and sort of add on to some of what Paul is talking about. It's really clear that Hallquist didn't do as obviously as well as she was hoping to do, but even as well as she was predicting she was going to do in the Chittenden County area, even though as a whole she took the county. I think it's really hard to discount the fact that she raised only about as quarter about a quarter as much of the money as she thought she was going to. She was hoping to raise somewhere around $2 million. She ended up with somewhere around $500,000, right? So sort of the money just didn't come in for her, which means we didn't see her on TV. There are all of these ways in which any challenger to an incumbent faces a name recognition problem that's a high bar in most cases. Like challengers just are generally not as well known as incumbents are. And here, Hallquist just ran into persistent problems with finding money to make her name known. Now, that said, that brings us back to why didn't she get the money, mm-hmm. right? And it's quite clear she was hoping for money from external groups funding Democrats, external groups funding LGBTQ candidates, external groups funding women. And that money, by and large, didn't come, I don't think, because she was transgender, but because, generally speaking, Phil Scott is well-liked.
And also, I mean, it's also worth noting that this is such a nationalized election that groups outside of Vermont had to make decisions about where to put that money, and this, you know, just wasn't a priority. I would also just note that Christine Hallquist got into the race rather late. So I think she got in around, I don't remember exactly. Was it April? Maybe it was a little bit earlier. But Sue Minter was in the race for, you know, I want to say 8 or 10 months longer, and raised significantly more money on her own. And this was Christine Hallquist's first time running for public office, whereas Scott has been on the statewide ballot. This is now his fifth time. And that really makes a difference in Vermont elections. So it's definitely money's a huge factor, and incumbency in general is a huge factor.
Let's take a look at the race for Congress. In the U.S. House, the Democrats picked up at least 30 seats on Tuesday night to regain control of that chamber. Congressman Peter Welch was easily reelected to a seventh term in office, and here are his thoughts on election night.
We have to have some humility. This will be a rejection of Trump, not an endorsement of the Democrats. what we will have achieved is an opportunity to earn people's trust by what we do.
Matt Dickinson, some Democrats in Washington want to start impeachment hearings against the president. Some, like Representative Welch, want to wait until they see a final report issued by special counsel Robert Mueller. It seems like there is some disagreement within the Democratic caucus on how aggressive the Democrats should be in challenging President Trump. What's at stake for them?
Control of the House is at stake for them. Most of the gains that they made were in relatively purple seats that the Republicans had won in two previous wave elections. And the Democrats simply sort of won them back. But there's no evidence that they expanded their coalition here. And I think Congressman Welch is quite right. They have a 2 years to sort of make the case for why they should retain that majority. And some of the polling results and the exit polls suggest the public as a whole is not very interested in pursuing impeachment. The one exit poll question we had, the majority of Americans were against further impeachment. The problem, of course, for Democrats is their base is really strongly in favor of investigating the president. So you've got to strike a balance here. You want to not simply be spinning your wheels for 2 years, having Democratic Republican administrators testifying before you. You want to show some legislative productivity. On the other hand, you're probably not going to get any bills past the Senate. So it's a question, again, I think, of laying down a marker to show what we can do in control of one chamber and making the case that we should expand that control in 2020.
And you think we're looking most likely at some gridlock in Washington because Senate Republicans will block most of the bills that are passed by the House Democrats?
Yeah, it's been very difficult to find bills in which you can compromise. I mean, the areas where you think you might see it, like a comprehensive immigration reform, where you had sort of moderates in both sides coming together under George Bush, it was torpedoed by extremists. And I don't mean that in a bad connotation, but ideologically to the left of the Democrats and the conservative wing of the Republican Party torpedoed that. And nothing that happened in this election changed the essential dynamics of Congress in that the parties are deeply polarized and ideologically very well sorted. So I'm not seeing a lot of areas in which you can say, yeah, they're going to find basic agreement and move forward here on a bipartisan manner.
Today in the program, we're looking at the election results from Tuesday night and trying to sort out what it all means. Let's talk to Dave in West Haven. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
What's on your mind?
I've got a social commentary here. I grew up in Burlington in Chittenden County. I currently live in Addison County, and I currently work in Rutland County, and I've also worked in Washington County and sort of all over the state. So I sort of feel like I've got a decent pulse on the cross-section of what people are feeling. And I think the dirty little secret is that Vermont is not as liberal as everybody wants it to be. And there was that Saturday Night Live skit a few weeks ago that sort of poked fun at Vermont being the ideal place for the neo-Nazis and all that. And while I think that's extreme, I think that there is some sort of tongue-in-cheek validity to that. And I think that overall, as a whole, outside of Burlington, and I don't mean Chittenden County, I mean Burlington itself. Other than that, I don't think that Vermont is ready for Christine Hallquist. I voted on Tuesday on both sides of the party line. I did vote for Phil Scott, but I also voted for several Democrats and progressives. And I talked to a lot of people in the state, and I feel like Phil Scott appeals to a lot of people on both sides because, I mean, he has a history of reaching across the aisle. But I also feel like Christine Hallquist is scary, and that's why people didn't vote for her. But I also feel that they're using common sense, thinking that, you know, maybe we can't afford this $15 an hour minimum wage because everything else will go up. In addition to that, we'll be paying $8, $9 a gallon for milk. Your thoughts on that?
All right, Dave, thanks very much for your phone call. Paul Heintz, what are your thoughts? Do you think Vermont is given a label of being a very liberal place when, in fact, it's not?
Well, you know, there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, I think in some ways this is a very liberal state compared to others in the nation, but that does not mean that everyone here is liberal, of course. And of course, you know, I think the point about tolerance is a really important one to ponder. There have been countless stories in recent years about racially motivated incidents in the state, most notably the harassment that Representative Kaya Morris, who is an African-American woman, faced in Bennington. And it was a factor in her decision to not seek re-election, to drop out of her race earlier this year. You know, I think that there is a tendency in Vermont to think that we are more enlightened than perhaps we are. You know, and I think that's what that Saturday Night Live skit got at. You know, at the same time, these are very complicated. There's so many dynamics that go into a single person's choice of who to vote for. I mean, the caller himself noted that he voted for Phil Scott, despite being someone who's, you know, to the left, it sounds like. And, you know, I don't think we should be too reductionist here and assume that because Phil Scott won, that means that, you know, everybody in Vermont is transphobic. I think that would obviously be overreaching as well. You know, one of the issues that I'm really curious about is how gun rights played into this. You know, you had Governor Scott supporting and proposing a number of bills to create Vermont's first gun laws. And I think that was an issue that people thought would really hurt him. And it did not in the end. In fact, it's quite possible that won him a number of votes, perhaps in those Chittenden County suburbs that I mentioned. You know, I talked to a lot of people anecdotally who thought that was a factor.
And Paul, you read my mind because I was just about to read an email from Nancy that asks, how much did Phil Scott's support of gun control legislation solidify his support by Democrats?
Yeah, well, and it seems like it did. You know, the risk for Scott on that one was more in the primary, the real risk would have been if there was a third party candidate in the general election, like a pro-gun conservative who could have taken away some of his base voters. But none of that happened. And in a head-to-head fight with a Democrat, you've got enough people who think, hey, he's, you know, he's not that conservative. I can vote for him. You know, Democrats saying that. Another factor is how he's dealt with Trump, right? This has been a huge problem for Republicans around the country, how to deal with this guy. He's enormously unpopular here in Vermont, less popular than in any other state in the country. And Scott, I think, has done a masterful job of playing that issue. I mean, I think it's genuine. I'm not suggesting that it's, you know, he's poll testing that one. From the very start, from the moment that Trump emerged in the national scene, Phil Scott has distanced himself from Trump, has very clearly taken Trump to task at times. And, you know, I think one mistake that Hallquist and the Vermont Democratic Party made this time around was that they tried to tie Phil Scott to Trump and suggest that he was, you know, just this Trumpist in disguise. And, you know, anyone who follows state politics knows that's just not true. It's not a credible argument. There are plenty of arguments you can make against Phil Scott, but that he is a supporter of Donald Trump just does not pass the straight face test.
Want to look at the other race down in Washington, that involving independent Senator Bernie Sanders, who won a very big victory on election night. Sanders says dealing with climate change is going to be one of his top priorities in 2019.
We are in dire circumstances, and people have laughed at me and attacked me when they say, Bernie, what do you think the major foreign policy crisis we face? And I said, it's climate change. And we have got to, right now, do everything we can to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energies like wind, solar, geothermal, and other technologies.
Matt Dickinson, Bernie Sanders invested a lot of time this fall campaigning for progressive Democratic candidates all across the country, certainly fueling speculation that he'll run for president in 2 years in 2020 after this strong showing he made in 2016. What do you think? Are we looking at another presidential bid by Bernie Sanders?
Well, one of the messages I think we're taking away from the midterm is that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party did not do particularly well in these midterm elections. They challenged a lot of more moderate Democrats and in most cases lost. There are some exceptions here. So if you're trying to read the tea leaves, You can't necessarily come out of this thinking Bernie Sanders solidified his position in the as sort of the leader of the Democratic Party. The second problem he's facing here is that he's going to have a lot of competition for that lane, to use an over-hyped word here, in the Democratic Party from Kamala Harris, possibly Kristen Gillibrand has flirted with that, although I think she's probably dropped out. Cory Booker. So we'll see. My sense is his time as the front man for the Democratic Party in presidential politics is probably past, and more of his influence, I think, is exercised behind the scenes, raising money for candidates who share his progressive values. But Bernie is inherently unpredictable, and he's a dynamite shape for a guy his age. So we'll see.
Ellen Anderson, what do you think?
I think I have to disagree a little bit with Matt on this part. It's absolutely true that a bunch of the seats the Democrats picked up are in purple districts. This is precisely what we would expect. The blue districts were Democrat. Right. So their only movement they're going to get is into purple districts. I think if we take a look at progressive candidates, I think many of them did extremely well. And even if they didn't win or may not have won, I say, looking at the Georgia gubernatorial race and the Senate gubernatorial race, and even Beto O'Rourke's failed senatorial race in Texas, they came very close and mobilized a lot of energy. I mean, this was an election that put a bunch of new faces into the House. They put in, we now have over 100 women who are in the House. We now have our first Native American elected officials in the House of Representatives ever, right? We're a more diverse party. We've brought in new visions. Like, the Democrats have just broadened out quite considerably, and I think that's where a lot of the energy is. Now, does that mean that Bernie is going to be the person to lead that? That's a different question, but I think that the progressives are a resoundingly large force within the Democratic Party right now.
Paul, what Bernie Sanders said this week was some of the Democrat U.S. Senate candidates and the incumbents lost because they weren't progressive enough. And he was talking about Claire McCaskill in Missouri, Joe Donnelly in Indiana, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota. We've got about 30 seconds, Paul. Is he going to run again?
I would disagree with Matt and say that Senator Sanders is quite predictable. I think he's been saying the same thing for 40 years. One thing he's been very clear about is he wants to advance his ideas, and I think he is going to want to do that in the 2020 election. I'm not saying he's going to win, but I do think it's likely he's going to run. His staff is setting up the shell of a campaign for him. I think he wants to be part of this conversation, and I think he starts out in a good place because he's better known than a lot of these other candidates. It'll get more challenging along the way as voters get to know people like Booker and Harris and some of the newcomers.
Well, this has been a great discussion looking at the election results from Tuesday night. Many thanks to our guest today, Paul Heinz of 7 Days, UVM political science professor Ellen Anderson, and Middlebury College political science professor Matt Dickinson. Thank you all very much for being on the panel today.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, Bob.